Hello, and welcome to the Napoleonic Quarterly, which takes the epic conflicts of the Napoleonic period 3 months at a time, taking us from the early period of the French Revolution all the way through the Battle of Waterloo, through however many episodes we're going to travel through. We're here at the break between season 4 and season 5, and we are here to provide you with some bonus episodes. My name is Bernie Campbell, and it's my pleasure to be here with you. I want to thank Quartermaster General Alex Stevenson for giving me this opportunity to be with you today and to help provide some of this bonus content here between season 4 and season 5. Today we're going to be talking about book recommendations because I'm an amateur historian of the Napoleonic period. My degree is in American history, and I spend my day teaching American history to American high school students. And so the Napoleonic period has been something of a side interest of mine, although more recently as they've shifted my teaching assignment to teaching more world and Western civilization. But and as I've picked that up along the way, I love to read books and I love to get new book recommendations. I have proceeded through both Charles's book and Alex's book on the time period since starting to listen to the podcast. And I'm here today with our panelist, esteemed panelist, Professor Charles Esdale, to chat with him about his book recommendations for the time period. Welcome, Charles. Thank you for being here with me today.
Good afternoon from the Isle of Man. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope that we can come up with some interesting ideas for people.
I think that sounds like a great idea. And so I've got sort of a list of questions that I generated to kind of get some conversation started. So I'm going to just start with this first one here. And other than your book or Alex's book, both of which obviously we highly recommend, what would you recommend as the best book for an overall view of the time period here that we've been discussing on the Napoleonic Quarterly?
It depends what you want. Do you want a campaigns of Napoleon book? In which case I would say David Chandler's Campaigns of Napoleon. But what you will get is, of course, the campaigns of Napoleon. You won't get a complete introduction to the Napoleonic Wars. When I wrote my book, Napoleon's Wars and International History, the starting point I set out from was that there is a Napoleonic Europe which does not involve Napoleon. You know, there are places which Napoleon never went to, which still had important things happening. So if you want to you know, find out about Napoleon's battles, many years on from its first appearance in 1966, there's still nothing better, I think, than the campaigns of Napoleon. Do you want a biography of Napoleon? That's another way into the period. Well, the obvious place to go is Philip Dwyer's book. Well, a three-volume biography. The first volume, I think, is called Citizen Emperor. Unfortunately, I haven't got any of these on my shelves at the moment, so I can't just lean around and get one for you.
We know you had problem with shelves.
Yes. Well, fortunately, the shelves are now vertical rather than at 45 degrees to vertical. Unfortunately, a huge amount of my books are still in store back across, and I haven't been able to get them over yet. So I am struggling. To go back to recommendations. Yes, as I say, Philip Dwyer's three-volume biography, it's the best biography around. It's critical, which means I approve of it automatically. But the point is that it doesn't just regurgitate the usual story. Even if you're an admirer of Napoleon, it would be good for you to read it because it, you know, forces you to take a step back and think, well, yeah, maybe I should think about that or whatever. Then there's another approach. When I was originally thinking about this, what I thought we were going to talk about was kind of five books which got me into the subject many years ago.
By all means, let's talk about that.
So I'm kind of thinking on my feet at the moment. But one of those books was a book by a professor of mine at university called John Gooch, and it's called Armies in Europe. And that really introduced me to the whole notion of war and society, the idea that battles always have a social and political context, armies always have a social and political context. And those are ideas which have influenced me enormously. And if you'll forgive me, I'll come back to my own work again here, because confusingly, I have two books with very, very similar titles. You've got Napoleon's Wars and International History, which is the one I presume that you're familiar with. And then there is another one called The Wars of Napoleon. This was not my fault. Like many authors, I am much exposed to editors. And I wrote the original edition of The Wars of Napoleon many, many years ago. It came out in 1995. And I went on to write my Napoleon's Wars. But originally, Napoleon's Wars in International History was not going to be called Napoleon's Wars. It was going to be From Amiens to Waterloo, An International History of Napoleonic Wars. But the good people at Penguin decided they wanted Napoleon in the first part of the title. And I get sent the dust jacket. And it says, Napoleon's Wars in International History. And I ring them up and I say, can we have a chat about a dust jacket? Oh, yes. Do you like it? Well, yes. But you do realise that I've already got a book out called Napoleon's Wars. And there was a long and pregnant pause. And then this rather small voice said, oh. But it was too late to do anything about it. So I'm stuck with these two books, which everybody thinks are the same, and they get mixed up, but they're actually completely separate books. The Wars of Napoleon, which is now out in a second edition, it came out in 2018 or something like that. The Wars of Napoleon is not a narrative history at all. It's a discussion of Napoleonic Europe. It looks at the way in which Napoleonic Wars impacted Europe. It looks at reform in the French Empire, though I see reform in the French Empire very much as basically honing up Napoleon's instrument of war. It looks at institutional responses to the challenge of Napoleon, in other words, what the Habsburg Empire did, what the Russians did. It's a completely different book, and that will give you, a different type of overview again, if you see what I mean. I suppose, being the horrendously egotistical fellow that I am, I would say that the best thing to do would be to read my Wars of Napoleon in conjunction with Napoleon's Wars, because I do draw together an awful lot of material from, I mean, they're both works of synthesis, I don't deny that. So I draw together an awful lot of material, and if you obviously I give lots of bibliographical references and all the rest of it, and if you really don't like my version of Napoleon, or if you want to find out more, then there's plenty of pointers showing you where to go.
That's excellent. You talked about some of those books that inspired you, and you mentioned one. What's one of the other ones that you had in mind, that got you into this period in the first place?
Well, if you mean really, really got me into this period in the first place, can I start off with something which might sound very flip, I suppose. Over in the States or Canada or wherever, forgive me, are you in the States?
Yes, I am in the States. I'm in New Hampshire, which is, you know, some people think it's already in Canada, but
yes, I can imagine certain people in places like Kansas or Mississippi not being entirely convinced it's in the United States. But moving on. I've no idea if they appeared in the United States, but when I was a little boy, we had this wonderful series called the Ladybird books. And they were deliberately designed for children. And they covered all sorts of things. I mean, you know, that the natural world, traveling. There was a series about a boy and a girl who had appeared to have incredibly wealthy parents who would take them all over the world when they went on business trips and things like that. So they went off to Australia. And yes, there's one on the United States. But more to the point, you had the Ladybird history books. And there was a whole series of these on, you know, major figures in history, you know, Alfred the Great, Henry V, Henry VIII, Queen Victoria, Florence Nightingale. Funnily enough, people like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln didn't figure. but a volume duly appeared on Napoleon. And I've still got it, well, I would say sitting on my shelf. It's in a box somewhere. But it's just a little book, maybe 48 pages, something like that. Picture one side. Whenever you open double page spread, picture one side, full page picture, and page of text on the other. And I acquired this when I was about 8, 9, I suppose. And the way it handles the story of Napoleon, you had, you know, for a children's book, you had quite a detailed account of how he gets to power. And, you know, it takes you up to Brumaire. And then it basically says, you know, it deals the whole of the Napoleonic Wars in like a couple of pages. And it's everybody was nasty to Napoleon. Nobody liked him. There were lots and lots of wars. And then he gets defeated at the Battle of Waterloo. And you did have a bit about the Battle of Waterloo. And there was this kind of gap in the middle, which I was desperate to find out more about. You know, I was intrigued. You know, what has happened? You know, what were these battles? And so on and so forth. And that acted as a hook. And I think my parents picked up on that because I remember it well. Christmas 1969, I was given David Howarth's book, A Near Unthing, on the Battle of Waterloo. Now, it's funny looking back on it because sitting where I am now, it's the sort of Waterloo book which, frankly, I despise. I mean, as you may or may not know, over the past few years, I've done a lot of work on Waterloo. I wrote a book on the Hundred Days, which is about France's rejection of Napoleon in 1815. I wrote a book called Walking Waterloo, which is a, you know, a guidebook to the battlefield for walkers. Impress at the moment. Oh, no, it's actually come out. I've forgotten this. It has actually come out. A book about the way in which the historical simulations industry has handled Waterloo. And it's called Wargaming Waterloo. So it analyzes Avalon Hill products, SPI products, things like that.
You're speaking my language.
you can get it online for free from United States Marine Corps University Press.
Oh, excellent. We'll have to look into that.
Anyway, so I've done a lot of work on Waterloo. And I've become very, very aware of how the traditional account of Waterloo is shot through with all sorts of errors, misconceptions, and to be blunt, downright lies and falsehoods. Unfortunately, everybody tends to write down what Napoleon said about it. And so the cavalry charges Napoleon's fault. Actually, they were Napoleon's fault, but the cavalry charges are Ney's fault, for example. And so on and so forth. And it's a litany of excuses, you know, basically designed to get Napoleon off the hook. And Howarth pretty much falls into that tradition in many respects. I mean, the story of Waterloo he tells is the traditional story of Waterloo that everybody knows. However, at the age of Christmas 1969, I would have been 10. At the age of 10, I genuinely found it inspiring because I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but Howarth actually takes a whole series of individual participants, some of them British, some of them French, and uses their memoirs to follow them through the battle. And that was an important moment because it was a moment when I realized, if you like, in a very sort of dim and 10-year-old sort of way, that history wasn't just about great men, great women, famous men, famous women. It was also about very ordinary people, if you like, who were caught up in it all. Now, of course, at the age of 10, I couldn't have vocalized that, but I sensed it was important. I sensed it mattered. And this desire to get to grips, if you like, with the experiences of ordinary people is something which has stayed with me and something which has inspired me.
That's very interesting. I think I'm going to have to, you know, despite the criticisms, Charles, I think I'm going to have to check that book out because it sounds very much like, I don't know how familiar you are with American history, but there's an American historian named Michael Shara who wrote a book on the Battle of Gettysburg called The Killer Angels.
Which
sounds very parallel to, you know, in terms of style, in terms of structure, it sounds very parallel to the book you're talking about.
And it's a very, very readable book. I mean, at the age of 10, you know, I absolutely devoured it. And I mean, I can genuinely remember sitting there in bed on that Christmas morning, having opened my stocking and absolutely burying myself in this book. So you know, it's a wonderful way in. It's just that, well, perhaps sadly, I've lost that 10-year-old innocence.
Yep, and that that happens to a lot of us when we study history. We tend to discover things that, you know, our younger selves maybe wish we hadn't figured out as we get older.
Well, absolutely, and looking back over my career, I've made myself very unpopular in many quarters. I mean, of course, you know, as you may, I don't know if you're on Twitter, but I mean, I've been involved in some dreadful rows on Twitter with Napoleonists, particularly American Napoleonists. So, you know, my views on Napoleon are unpopular, but also in terms of my work on Spain, you know, in many of my the things I've written. Well, I'm a kind of Marmite figure in Spain. There are some people who actually absolutely love me because I challenge the traditional narratives of Spanish history. And there are some people who hate me because I challenge the traditional narratives of Spanish history. But what I'm kind of getting at really is that it is the job of a historian, bluntly, to trample on people's dreams.
You know, your point about trampling on people's dreams and this sort of this struggle between you know, the past and understanding the present and understanding the past in the context of the present is something that's playing itself out here in the States. We're just past the holiday that's variously referred to as Columbus Day, celebration of Christopher Columbus. And in other parts of this country, it's now referred to as Indigenous Peoples Day, in recognition of the suffering of Indigenous people, oftentimes at the hands of Europeans. And there are a lot of people who are upset about that transition because they don't like letting go of the things that they had learned as children. So, you know, the tension as a historian to kind of illuminate the past in new ways at the same time as kind of disillusioning old myths is certainly something that is a struggle.
And of course, when it's part of the national myth, it's even worse, because, of course, Columbus Day in Spain is a big national holiday. In the center of Madrid, there's this enormous monument to Columbus. It's in Columbus Square, the Plaza de Colón. It's literally next door to the National Library. And you've got these huge concrete blocks representing Columbus's ships, sailing across the sea. Curiously, they're heading for this waterfall where there's like a big fountain but the water flows down over a walkway, so you can actually walk underneath this walkway with the water coming down. And it rather looks as if they're imagining that the world was flat and Columbus is going to sail off the edge of it, but symbolism or something.
Coming back to some book recommendations, though, one of the questions I had for you today is, what's a hidden gem in Napoleonic literature that you feel doesn't get the attention it deserves? What's something that you've run across that you say, why don't more people know about this?
That's an interesting question. Well, it's not quite Napoleonic, but I guess it will count. I was very, very good friends for many years with a British writer called Paddy Griffith, who was a prolific author on military themes. He wrote a lot on the American Civil War, for example. But he wrote a very, very good book called The French Revolutionary Army's Art of War, or something like that. Again, forgive me, I haven't got the book to hand. It is a pretty detailed critique. It really attacks the notion of, the French all being fired up by political ideology and all rushing on the enemy and overwhelming them by verve and vigor and the possibility of getting promoted and all the rest of it. And that's all a myth. And he takes it apart very well. And he basically says, yes, the revolutionary armies won a lot of battles, but they won battles when they outnumbered the enemy. And when they didn't outnumber the enemy, they often got whipped. So the notion of the French Revolution having thrown up this completely new and unbeatable system of waging war is really sort of challenged by him.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I like that. We'll have to look into that one. We are going to put a link to a lot of these titles in the show notes, and I'm going to create a page on the website to share out links to where you can find all these books that we talked about today on the Napoleonic Quarterly website, and we'll post this in the show notes as well.
But if you want another contribution at this point, my old friend Rory Muir's book, I can't for the life of me remember the title. Probably two or three books which have got very similar titles. But it's basically tactics. It's basically the experience of battle in the Napoleonic Wars. And it's a very, very detailed analysis of what actually happens on the battlefield.
Is it Tactics and the Experience of Battle in the Age of Napoleon?
That's it.
It's published in 1998.
That's it.
He's got several books out. He's got, I just pulled him up here on side page. He's got a book on Salamanca.
That is a very, very good book as well. If you wanted a battle book, Battle of Albuera, Guy Dempsey.
Mm-hmm.
Rory's book on Salamanca is really, really good. It's one of the best battle books I know. Guy Dempsey, another British writer, wrote a very, very similar one on Albuera, the Battle of Albuera in 1811. And again, it's a masterly work of analysis. It really is. Albuera is particularly interesting because you have a classic example of why this ingrained American notion that the French troops were supposed to advance in column and fight in line is complete nonsense. This is over and over again. You get this from American scholars like James Arnold. I mean, he's written articles about it, and the general idea is the French manoeuvred in column, and then when they got to fighting distance of the enemy, they deployed into line and they fought in line. The trouble is that theory simply doesn't work, because once you're committed to an attack, in other words, once you're marching towards the enemy and you're getting into musket range, if you stop, you risk losing all momentum. And if you start firing, then you're not going to go anywhere, because it's a very, very human reaction in combat. You know, if somebody's firing at you, you want to fire back. It's a comforting thing to do. It gives you a routine. You know, you're loading and firing, and you've got to remember to do it all in the right order. It's a sort of comfort blanket, if you like. And you can convince yourself and convince your officers that you're fighting. I mean, you are fighting. You're pointing your gun at the enemy and you're pulling the trigger, and hopefully you'll kill someone or other. The trouble is, of course, it's a totally pointless activity. What actually happens is that the advance breaks down. And if the enemy are any good, and the British did tend to be rather good, they will come at you with a bayonet charge, and that's it. You're going off somewhere else at speed. And at Albuera, what happens is that you've got a mixed force of Portuguese who are on the left flank, British who are in the centre, and Spaniards who are on the right. And they're all lined up behind a nice long ridge, very good fighting position. Would have been absolutely splendid if the French had attacked it head on, but they didn't. They didn't attack it head on. Soult was in command, and he organises this gigantic left hook. The ground is very undulating, and he uses the configuration of the ground to take a large part of his army first southwards, then westwards, then northwards. I mean, the battle is fought on a sort of north-south angle, if you like. He comes up and he hits the end of the Spanish line. And he's poised to roll up the entire Allied line from the south. And to their immense credit, the nearest Spanish troops, they managed to wheel back and refuse to flank. And they confront two divisions of French infantry backed up by other troops, cavalry on the flank. And they, it's four battalions. And they basically stand firm. And the two French divisions are one behind the other. And the commander of the leading division takes it into his head to form line. Had he steamed on in column, he'd have smashed his way through. but he forms in line, and the French get bogged down in a firefight, which gets them nowhere, and it gives the British troops who are in the centre of the line time hastily to march south and basically take over. Very, very interesting battle. I mean, another incident, it's often said that infantry couldn't stand against cavalry unless they were formed in square. Well, in another moment of the battle, the French launch a charge against an advancing division of, it's a mixed division of Portuguese and British troops, and they're formed in line, but they actually charge the Portuguese part of the division. And, the Portuguese see them off with a single volley, formed in line. You know, so really, really interesting battle. So the name to go to there is Guy Dempsey.
Well, that kind of gets to one of my other questions, which was, what are your favorite books, or what do you think are the best books on particular subjects? And I think you've identified a couple right here between Rory Muir and Guy Dempsey on his books on some of the things in Spain. And of course, you are the expert on Spain, or at least one of the preeminent ones. So those are good recommendations to have. I am going to ask you one other question that's been on my mind, because I will say that from my perspective, my introduction to the Napoleonic period came, as probably many of us who come to this period did, was through fiction. And I was a fan of, a very big fan of the novels of Patrick O'Brien, who I'm sure many of us are familiar with. But, you know, I'm interested to see what's your favorite work of Napoleonic era fiction, Charles? What's something that you've read that takes place in the time period that you're like, this was a really good, well done book?
I've never been able to come to terms with Napoleonic naval stuff. I've tried repeatedly. But as soon as they start splicing the main brace or whatever it is they do, I mean, my mind just switches off. I find it completely impenetrable, and I just lose interest. And I've never, ever managed to read a Napoleonic naval novel from start to finish. In terms of fiction I have read, well, you know, of course, I know about I've read almost all the Sharp books. He's just produced yet another potboiler, and I am refusing point blank to read it. It's called Sharp's Command or something. Or not Bernard Cornwell. Well, he brought an awful lot of people into being interested in the Peninsular War in particular. It's just that if you deconstruct the books, they really aren't that much good. There's a much better series about the British Army in the Peninsular War by a chap called Adrian Goldsworthy. And I think the first title is called True Soldier Gentleman.
Let me, I'm pulling his bibliography up here. Novels, True Soldier Gentleman, 2011, his first novel.
Yep, that's right. And there's about six of them. Those are infinitely better than the Sharp novels. But I think my favourite work of Napoleonic fiction by a chap called R.F. Delderfield, Seven Men of Gascony.
I am familiar with that book, which probably not many folks on this side of the pond are. I was talking about this with Alex earlier. My Desert Island book, if I'm going to take a book to a desert island, is actually R.F. Delderfield's To Serve Them All My Days. I don't know if you're familiar with that
one.
But that was actually the book that inspired me to become a teacher. So that was that's very interesting that name came up. So, yeah, Seven Men of Gascony. Excellent. That's an excellent book.
I mean, if you wanted a more serious offering, well, I mean, of course, I'm going to say War and Peace. I'm not a great man for reading classics. You know, I have to do an awful lot of reading for my job, and therefore when I'm not reading for my job, I usually want to switch off and read detective novels and things like that. But War and Peace, I think it's something which really does have to be read by anybody interested in the Napoleonic era. Very, very thought-provoking book. And a very, very interesting picture of Russia in 1812. I mean, there's stuff in there which you're not going to find anywhere else, but which Tolstoy got, at least not in English, but which Tolstoy got from, you know, talking to people who'd experienced it.
Well, yes, War and Peace. That is the novel, if you're going to read a novel about the Napoleonic period. I've never actually read it. My wife has read it. She and her friend, best friend, read it. It's kind of a book club challenge sort of thing. My wife is a chemist, so I was a little bit surprised, but they got through it. I haven't, but typical of a historian, my to-be-read pile is about as tall as my head, so I'll get there someday. Well, I think this has been wonderful, Charles, and I appreciate the time that you've given us today to talk about these books, and we've got a lot of good recommendations that we're gonna get to all of you and put some links in. And do you have any final words or final suggestions for us before we wrap up the day, Charles?
Well, one thing I was going to talk about, oddly enough, was the movie Waterloo.
Okay.
You know, it takes me back to being a very excited 10-year-old in the summer of, no, hang on a sec. Yes, I would have been a 10-year-old because it came out in the early summer of 1970, and I would have turned 11 in August of that year. All the best people are Leos. But yeah, I mean, the film Waterloo, that was certainly one of the things which got me hooked. However, I don't know if you've ever heard this quip about J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, Lord of the Rings. Someone or other once said, if you don't think that J.R.R. Tolkien is the greatest author there's ever been at the age of 14, there's something wrong with you. But if you still think that he's the greatest author that there's ever been at the age of 44, there's really something wrong with you. And it's the same with the movie Waterloo. It's spectacular, but it's also spectacularly awful. Even as a 10-year-old, you know, and I had read David Howarth's A Near Run Thing. And I went to see it. And I can remember saying to my dad, but it didn't happen like that. Particularly thinking about The Last Stand of the Old Guard, which incidentally didn't happen at all in any form. Now that's complete invention. So, yeah, viewing it now, God, there's an awful prospect having to sit through it again. But viewing it now, of course, I'm highly critical. Of course, I can see the errors, downright silliness in places. But as a hook that got me interested, as something that made me think, yes, absolutely, hats off to it. And what I would say in terms of cinematographical critique, if you like, it handles the battle very, very badly in all sorts of ways. I mean, like, you know, I could sit here for the next 6 hours and tell you what an awful film it is. But the first half hour, when you've got, first of all, Napoleon surrendering at Fontainebleau and going into exile, and then coming back to France and exposing his breast to the muskets of the troops sent to hunt him down and so forth. It is a brilliant piece of cinema. It puts over a version of events which I am deeply, deeply opposed to, in disagreement with. You know, I wrote a book about, you know, the return of Napoleon to France in 1815, and it's called Napoleon, France and Waterloo, The Eagle Rejected. And it's basically about how France rejects Napoleon, does not rush to follow the colours and so forth. You know, lots of people are just absolutely horrified. Horrible fellow has reappeared. So it puts over the Napoleonic legend, but it does so absolutely brilliantly. And I do have to say that to this day, Rod Steiger is my Napoleon, an extraordinarily brilliant portrayal. And it has to be said that Christopher Plummer as Wellington was also very good. So I think I'll take a rain check on watching the thing myself. But, you know, if you can regard a film as a work of historiography, and I think you can, it's certainly an interesting place to start from.
And we'll have an opportunity to perhaps get another starting point this fall when the new movie comes out, the one with Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon. I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out in November. We'll have to see how that one compares from a historiography point of view to the Waterloo film. We'll be hoping to get a bonus episode to get your reaction. And hopefully I'm looking forward to the opportunity, perhaps once we've all seen it, to get together for a bonus episode on reactions to the film sometime after November when the movie comes out, if we're all going to go see it. So that'll be exciting.
I fear to say that I know I'm going to have to go and watch it. I do know. But in all honesty, everything I've heard about it, I'm just filled with dread. However, know your enemy, as they say.
Indeed. And it would be interesting, and perhaps some other time we'll have an opportunity to have kind of conversation, because as we've had this talk today, it occurs to me that, you know, in history, we have this saying that history is written by the winners. But with regards a lot of the context of the Napoleonic Wars, because so much of it was based on, you know, memoirs and writings of Napoleonic marshals, and even, you know, interviews with Napoleon himself while he was in exile, you kind of get the sense that, you know, to a certain extent, there's a broad stroke of the Napoleonic Wars that's written by the loser.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is very much an inversion of the normal run of things. I mean, you could say that Napoleon lost the war, but he won the peace.
Oh, and what's interesting about that, Charles, is we have that conversation on this side of the pond with regards to the American Civil War to a great degree. You know, the Confederacy lost the war, but to a certain extent, there's this sense that they won the narrative following the conclusion of the war.
I am convinced of that. As you know, I'm an absolute inveterate member of the Twitterati, or whatever the phrase is. and I've been party to many, many debates on the American Civil War. I mean, in fact, there's been one which has been rumbling on all of yesterday and all of today with sort of three or four people just discussing at length Ewell at Gettysburg and what would have happened if Stonewall Jackson had been there. And you know, they're not even Americans, they're Brits.
Yes, those are certainly topics that rumble on in conversations that I've had in college and for a long time in my profession, and with students even, who particularly well-informed, or I'll use the term loosely, well-informed or historically interested students. You don't always get them at my level of teaching, because history is a required class, so you get a lot of people who are punching the clock, as it were, but we do get the occasional bright star who gets really into the subject, and sometimes they come out really well, and sometimes it's kind of like, I don't know where you're getting your information.
Yeah. Well, I can come up with a few suggestions.
I'm sure.
Shelby Foote is one of them.
Oh, yes. He features prominently in Ken Burns's documentary on the American Civil War. He's quite the character.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a long way from Napoleon.
Yes, it is.
I am not going to be drawn into discussing or giving you my views on the Confederacy.
Let's not. But
I will say something, though. A book which really inspired me and helped me in my writing, Peter Parrish's book, The American Civil War, along with Hugh Thomas's book, The Spanish Civil War. Both of them are examples of historians writing about a conflict, but doing so in a way which puts equal weight on the political background, the social background. Certainly many, many moons on from when I first read it, Peter Parrish's book remains my go-to starter for the American Civil War.
Excellent. Well, I think on that note, we'll wrap this up. And again, thank you so much, Charles, for being with us today and allowing me to participate in this bonus episode process. I want to thank Alex, Quartermaster General Alex Stevenson, for giving me this opportunity to sort of helm this piece. I look forward to sitting down with Alex McKiparidze in some future time to chat with him about his book recommendations. And as always, we will provide you with some links and some information about all these books so you can find them and get them for yourselves as we rumble on in the Napoleonic Quarterly. Again, thank you so much for being with us today, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
And a final word from me, or a few final words from me, again in Manx, Goromayed, which means thank you, and Stanyat, which means goodbye. You all take care now.